so to repeat that phrase, a writer who had a big influence on Lyndon Johnson's Great Society War on Poverty programs was a man named Michael Harrington. Harrington wrote the book The Other America. The Other America was an examination of how can America be so prosperous, more prosperous than ever since in the 1950s and 60s, while at the same time have such huge pockets of poverty in places like Appalachia, Tennessee Valley area, and especially urban inner cities. Of course, if he's a socialist, then what's going to be his suggestions? But if America is supposed to be the land of the pretty, plenty, and the most prosperous nation, how do we, how should we address these you know, scathing problems of poverty pockets?
Redistribution of wealth.
Yeah, government action rather than depending so completely on free market economics. There ought to be much greater efforts towards redistribution of wealth, social spending programs, job creation programs, etc. So much of the war on poverty's programs that created more jobs or created job training programs or vocational addition to schools, lists of things of that nature. It is said that Johnson was influenced by Michael Harrington's book, The Other America. But I don't think, I think that's too simplistic. I'm sure that that looks good in an answer, but I would also say that that ignores the fact that Johnson had grown up in politics in Texas in the 30s as a New Dealer all along. And one of the reasons he was so concerned about the poor as well as the non-white poor was because as a small city or small town school teacher, he dealt with a disproportionate large number of Mexican-American students who were always poor and couldn't eat lunch, so he often gave his money away or brought lunch for the kids. So he saw what it was like for those people before he ever got into politics. And when he got into politics in Texas Democratic Party circles, it was through New Deal agencies like the National Youth Administration. So to say he doesn't become that concerned about social well-being until he reads a book in the 60s by a socialist is a bit naive compared to his previous history. But you can say, in addition to his previous life experiences, his ideas were crystallized.
What were we talking about?
L.E.J.
Okay.
The treatment.
Well,
L.E.J., when he had an operation on his stomach one time, in the, right on the White House lawn, just ripped his shirt up and showed his scar. It was just like that.
Wow.
In fact, remember Forrest Gump? There's something to that effect.
He wants to see the bullet wound.
Yeah.
Rear.
That's a reference to the crudeness of Johnson. That's where that's coming from.
Do Emma and Linda know about it?
They know about it. Because they were harassed yesterday about, that's not the right word, they were reminded that we were here. So anyway, Michael Harrington, The Other America, could come up. If anything, it could have come up in the multiple choice question. But back to our civil rights thingy. This claims that the freedom rides, or the sit-ins, rather, to start with, the sit-ins, I can get back to where that is on this, was launched by SNCC. And if so, then we have... this should have been ready, sorry.
What does SNCC stand for?
The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And an important person of SNCC, two important persons of SNCC, SNCC, will be Stokely Carmichael and H. Rapp Brown.
Number 29 on the sheets.
Are they there?
Mm-hmm.
I put them in there?
Number 29.
Cool.
Yeah.
I'm glad I put them in there. See, okay, here is. And what was the SCLC?
The Southern.
SCLC?
Southern Christian Leadership Conference?
Yes. And who led the Southern Christian Leadership Conference?
MLK.
Yes.
What number is that anonymous?
It's probably not on here. King's on here, but I bet the SCLC was left off.
It was.
What's that acronym?
Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Okay, now here's what I was looking for. So, the SCLC, and King, when do we first see him involved in civil rights activities? Looking for papers?
The
Pardon?
The bus boycott?
Yes, of 1955, December through 1956. So if we were doing, actually, we're kind of, there's a three parts to the civil rights thing. There's 50s, early 60s, and then mid-60s. And the three events I would use in the 50s would be the Brown case of 54, the Rosa Parks bus boycott in Montgomery in 55 and 56, and the Little Rock 57. And while they are not very impactful, they are historic. Johnson does shepherd through the Senate, as Senate Majority Leader, a civil rights bill in 57 and in 60, 1957 and 60, but they're not really well enforced. That's why the 64 one later is so much more important. But then when we get into the 60s civil rights activities, the first are the sit-ins, and number six here, at Woolworth's lunch counters in Greensboro, North Carolina, that it says was launched by SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. They are different from King. While both SCLC and SNCC, and CORE for that matter, in the beginning, all three are working on the same strategy of do not fight back, do not be violent, become the victims of an unjust society so you gain sympathy and respect, but they're not under the same umbrella. They're somewhat competitive with each other for who's going to become the leader of the black community, and they're also kind of respectful and cooperative with each other. What's important is, and that's what's going on at the end of the second sheet, when you get over to 29, by the mid-60s, a great number of the members of SNCC don't want to remain passive resistance nonviolent. They've become much more black power motivated, militant, thinking that if you slap our arm, we cut yours off. If you shoot at us, we mow you down type thing. It's that feeling of why should we constantly be the victims of things? We have the right to fight back, which in its most virulent form comes out in the Panther movement, the Black Panther organization.
Who were the Weathermen?
The Weathermen, who later were renamed the Weather Underground because Weathermen sounded sexist, was a group of zany, wacko revolutionaries who thought that capitalism should be overthrown through sabotage. Yeah, and they also tried to attach bombs to ships going off to Vietnam with supplies and soldiers on. No, they're not civil rights things. They're underground resistance to Vietnam War fighters. And they got their name from a Bob Dylan song, which said, you don't have to know which way the wind's blowing. You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind's blowing. That's how they got their name. But then the female members of the organization complained of the sexist men part of it. There was a PBS special here a while back about what happened to all the famous ones that disappeared and went underground. And finally, this is really interesting. When Reagan was first elected in 80, within the first year of 81, they all started coming out of the woodwork and giving themselves up before the lame duck period of Carter ended. Why?
Because I guess they thought Reagan would.
They thought Reagan would like execute or throw him in prison forever, and they wanted to still be under the Jimmy Carter administration getting their sentences. I mean, it wouldn't have been any different under Reagan, but that's how much these underground micro revolutionaries really feared Reagan was going to be the dictator. So. Which wasn't that out of place of fear.
He won't execute you because he'll just make you broke.
He's a lot milder than what we've seen lately. So SNCC launched the lunch counter sit-ins in Greensboro, North Carolina. Then the Freedom Riders in number 7, that was launched by CORE, Congress on Racial Equality. In fact, they have a little box down here on the SNCC thing where it says major civil rights organizations and their accomplishments. CORE, Congress on Racial Equality, the Freedom Rides, SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the sit-ins, and then later the Freedom Summer, the registration of voting in 1964. And then SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, was obviously going to be King's thing. So what can you name what King activities took place?
The March on Washington. Yeah.
That in 63, the March on Washington. Early on, the month the bus boycott in 55.
The marches through Montgomery?
Yes.
Or the Birmingham?
Well, there's two actually. And I'm kind of running out of order here. But one is the Birmingham protest about desegregating city facilities that's led to them being attacked and him put in jail and writing his letter. That's in 63. The Poor People's March and I Have a Dream speech in 63. Does that not sound like when the Morlocks call the Enoys to dinner time and Time Machine?
No.
doesn't it?
Yeah.
They all just kind of hypnotically are walking into the mouth of the dungeons. And anyway.
What were the two things Nick did? The freedom summer?
The first thing they did was the sit-ins in the Woolworths in Greensboro, North Carolina.
I thought that's what CORE did.
CORE was the freedom
riders. CORE is the freedom riders. According to this book and this book. Oh. I may have reversed myself a few seconds ago when I said it. And SELC is King's Activities, which we did say in 55 is the bus boycott. And to go chronologically in order, 63, Birmingham. 63, also March on Washington and speech. Then there is the 60-mile march, Selma, Alabama, to register voters in Alabama, which is attacked by the police on the bridges and on the roads, and the federal marshals have to come and escort them the rest of the way. And probably it's said in here that the Voting Rights Act got the impetus by what happened at the Selma March. Through the publicity associated with the attack on the Selma marchers, Johnson was able to push over the top the Voting Rights Act.
When was the garbage strikes?
That's in 68. That's a little bit later here. That's coming up. And what we're going to get into, and I haven't yet, in the late 20s of the second page, is these groups that feel like they're sick and tired of being the victims, they're sick and tired of being the passive resistors. They prefer to have a strong, militant, defensive society, the Nation of Islam, the Panther Movement. And SNCC itself goes in that direction. Because of the leadership of first Stokely Carmichael and later H. Rapp Brown, they become far more aggressive and militant and urban revolutionary minded. And there creates the problem with King has already got enough problems with Malcolm X, Nation of Islam. Very separatist, very militant, very anti-white, not to the point of causing violence, but to the point of who needs to work with whites whatsoever. So you kind of got, in the late 60s, the breakaway movements of the Nation of Islam, SNCC, and the Panther Movement, and King trying to still retain the non-violent solution.
Seems like a lot of Booker T. Washington versus Du Bois.
It is. There's a lot of competition for... There's probably personal things going on, like who wants to be the Al Sharpton or the Jesse Jackson leader type thing. So there's probably some personal desires to have voice over the community, but there's also differences in philosophy. Those who feel that King is just still being an Uncle Tom by not fighting back. I guess he didn't like that Uncle Tom.
Did I say you're the only person I've ever heard
to meet Uncle Tom? On the breakfast
table? We had Uncle Sam, right? Did Great Britain have an Uncle Sam type character?
John Bull.
Okay, I was trying to remember the name of that earlier.
Yeah.
Snick.
The Irish like to stick it to John Bull and twist the lion's tail. SNCC for a Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Were they the ones that the voting?
Yes, the Freedom Summer of 64. That's SNCC's. That was their major, after the sit-ins, their major focus of activity was registering voters in the South. So in a sense, you can kind of see the different directions. King's movement is, in most cases, addressing Jim Crow activity, trying to desegregate, whether it's the buses in Montgomery, whether it's the all of the city facilities in Alabama. That's where King first starts with his desegregation, while SNCC is very concerned with registering voters. Then King comes over also to the registering voter activity with the Selma March. So,
Selma, Alabama?
Mm-hmm. So that's in 65. Where the SNCC summer, I think it was in 64. But then there is this thing later in life where after voting has been accomplished and after civil rights has been accomplished through the 64 law and 65 act, there's still a movement in 65, 6, 7, and 8 to address what they say is that still the most looming problem, and that is economic disparity. That even if you have civil rights or you have the right to vote, if you have no way to get a job or get the education to get a job, it's pretty elusive to think that you're going to be economically equal.
They have a capitalist convention in Birmingham next year.
Do they? Cool. And so that's why King then focuses. Two new things comes to King in 67 to 68. Anti-war protest, anti-Vietnam, which made a lot of people in the movement uncomfortable. They said, you know, this is not a direct issue for black equality. If you go against the war, you're going to make us look unpatriotic. We had the We had enough hard time of time trying to disassociate ourselves with the communist movement and really try to the civil rights struggle.
But so weren't they also thinking, since they didn't have equal job opportunities, the war was to go fight?
Well, yeah, I did. That's that thing about the draft fell disproportionately on the poor because the wealthy could find deferment ways out, like going to college, and lots of times the disproportionate poor are going to be Mexican and black and other minorities.
So there was,
there was that argument about that the victims of the draft are the people of color in the country. But that's still not his main reason for opposing the war. It's not directly a how it affects black people thing. His argument is it's just unjust. And it does affect people of color, people on the far part of the planet.
Who is saying this?
This is King. And so therefore an injustice done to Asian people is like the injustice is done to black people without civil rights, that the war is morally wrong and is a war on people of color anyway. Different color maybe, but so there's a lot of division there because the thinking is if you make a lot of Americans mad at you for being anti-war, that doesn't help the civil rights movement. And the other focus he went into was trying to get better housing, better job opportunities, better employment opportunities, real economic gains for the black community, and that was a much harder uphill struggle. And you can kind of see where did, after his death, where did government continue to go to try to promote that? Affirmative action programs. That's the basis for affirmative action. And in one of his efforts to support a garbage worker strike in Memphis in 1968, April, that's when he's killed.
My uncle was in California, in the Navy at the time, and he heard that Dr. King was going to Memphis, and then he said the exact phrase, he shouldn't go to Memphis because they'll kill him if he does.
He said that beforehand? Is that just that he knew how they felt in Memphis?
He did, yeah, he was just knew how racist Memphis was, I guess.
This is about Chicago, not Memphis, but funny you say that. When he led some kind of a rally in Chicago, I'm not exactly sure what it was for, whether it was for desegregation. It couldn't be because they don't have Jim Crow up there, so it was probably a rally for improved hiring possibilities. The march was met with so much more severe violence in Chicago than they'd ever experienced down in the South, and he said, Southern racists need to come up north and take a lesson from the Northern racists on how mean you can truly be. King. So, I mean, that tells you something, that the focus of the times is supposedly on, gee, how behind the date the Southerners are. Why can't they get with the rest of the nation and treat black people equal? Well, the Chicago experience shows that they weren't really all that treated equal elsewhere. They just didn't have the laws on the books to separate them.
What did they do to force them, the horses and the dogs?
That was King's comment. I don't know.
The cattle farm.
Well, that's the police that did that, but he was talking about basic citizens who came out of the woodworks. And there were a lot of fierce demonstrations and violence that arose in Boston over court-ordered busing, so it's not all just a Southern thing. But now that I've talked my way through, I wanted to what I make sure I say. Let's go back and piece by piece put this together. If you're putting together a civil rights outline, again, we have the 54, 56, 55, and 57 events, Brown, Montgomery, Little Rock. Then we move up to item 6 on this sheet, the World War sit-ins in 1960. 1961, the Freedom Rides. That's number 7. Number 8, you have the sheets?
Yeah, okay. I do. There's somewhere.
Okay. Number 8, the difficulty that Meredith experienced trying to enter the University of Mississippi and the fact that he needed federal help to get there and got it.
Which sheets are number 8?
The one that won is 1960 election. Then there is Wallace standing in the door to prevent students at the University of Alabama from entering and having to be overruled by federal authority. And as it says, in both cases, the John Kennedy administration had to federalize troops to protect students entering both of those state institutions. Not chronologically in order, but on my sheet here is the Freedom Summer of 64 voter registration by SNCC. And it's coming up here. Then in 63, number 10, King repeats what went on in Montgomery in a different direction in Birmingham, trying to desegregate not just buses but many of the city's facilities, being told that he was not allowed to have a permit and demonstrate, launched the permit anyway, was attacked by not only citizens but by the police. Eugene Bull Connors being the chief of police in Birmingham that allowed the German Shepherd attacks, the fire hoses and cattle prods, etc. And after being arrested, King did write the letter from a Birmingham jail, which addressed the major reasons of what the movement was standing for, but also criticized others who attacked him for going too fast. His argument was, for centuries we've been criticized for going too fast, but you should be here with me in this jail now.
Who was attacking him for that?
Jewish rabbis, Christian ministers, other people who claimed to be sympathetic to civil rights, but were claiming you're making it worse by...
Caucasians?
Caucasians. And the tone of the letter of Birmingham Jail is somewhat reminiscent of the tone of the civil disobedience essay by Thoreau. What's the thesis of Thoreau's civil disobedience essay? That when a government does an unjust thing, its citizens, the best patriotic citizens, protest the government's actions even at the risk of going to jail. And that's kind of what he's saying is that the only way to change an unjust government's mistreatment on the civil rights issue is to oppose the unjust laws and, if necessary, go to jail for it. So there's where we see that link between Thoreau, Gandhi, and King in the strategy. And it is that strategy, I think, that the Nation of Islam, the Panther Movement, and SNCC later on, through Carmichael and Brown, just lose patience for. They just cannot continue to be the victims. They feel like there's no, it's not fair and not just to have to be unable to fight back. But there's a complete strategy difference going on there. So I think because of the book says things, that because of the attention drawn from what's previously happened, and especially the Birmingham incident, that's when JFK feels compelled in the first number 11 to start seeking civil rights legislation, which he had been ducking before. And why had Kennedy, who was not racist, he was sympathetic to black equality, dragging his feet before on trying to introduce the legislation?
So he needed the racist Democrat vote?
Mm-hmm. It's the classic dilemma of the Democratic Party, needing Southern Democrats to get other things done. And he gets lots of opposition when he starts to propose this legislation. And then there is the Poor People's March in August of 63 on Washington with the... We often associate this I Have a Dream speech with the event, but apparently at the time it was not the major focus event. And it kind of comes... Because King became real famous after that, it came to be perceived as the major event of the rally. And because of King's efforts here, again in 1964, what noteworthy award was he given? Nobel Peace Prize in 64. And the Nobel Peace Prize granting is rarely without some political motive behind it. What is the Nobel Committee usually trying to send a signal of?
This needs to be a doctor.
Yeah, and so that's why, like for example, when Carter got his award, it was their way of trying to say Carter's opposition to the Iraq War needs to be listened to. It's not just a lifetime achievement award, it's as how rare it is for a previous president to criticize, it's that openly, a current president's policies.
Who depicts the Nobel?
There's a committee in Sweden of people who...
The good people of Stockholm?
I guess so, yeah.
How would the greatest committee be part of?
Yeah, that'd be cool. Mm-hmm. Pretty exciting. Good part-time job. Good on resume. And
Nobel selection committee?
Yeah. And why, in a similar vein... Why are there rumors to the effect that Gore may be nominated next year for a Nobel Prize?
It's inconvenient truth.
The global warming argument, and again, it would be a political way of trying to nudge our government into being more into the green revolution than it has been.
I still find it ironic that we have a Peace Prize named for the dude that invented dynamite.
Well, it's like Pulitzer awarding the Pulitzer Prize for good journalism when you've got to start lying and exaggerating to Yellow Press journalism in the Spanish Civil War. It's not at all that surprising. So
Nobel
there.
Didn't have bad intentions like
see, this dynamite will open up mines to build railroads and open up the cliff to put a winery in.
I really don't think he wanted to.
Oh my God, they're killing people with an explosive that I created. Why would they misuse it? Shocked to see gambling going on in here. So the giving of the prize to King in 64 was a strong urge by the Nobel Committee to try to convince the United States to adopt civil rights measures. And, of course, it did occur. as we don't see on this sheet here, but we do see it coming on number 22 of the next sheet. And this book here, the Tyndall book, does much to say how much Johnson really did work the idea of Kennedy as a martyr, and for the sake of our slain president, we need to pass this legislation that he wanted so badly, and that was a useful factor in getting it done. So that would be that first section of civil rights. Then there's the re-election of Johnson, and in the second section of civil rights activities, there has already been the Freedom Summer of Registration going on by SNCC in Mississippi and Alabama. And this is where this comes in. Apparently, within a week's time of the march on Washington going into 64, it's at that point in time when the three civil rights workers are murdered in Philadelphia, Mississippi. A little bit earlier than that, a church in Birmingham was blown up, killing white children, black children in the church. And there is also the killing of Medgar Evers.
That Rockwell painting that I told you about, mm-hmm. about the civil rights workers, I think maybe about the
church?
Voters.
Or the voter registration?
Yeah.
Do you have it? So where, let me get that straight on the Evers and the church thing.
What number are you on?
I am flirting with 22 through 24. Let me read to you from the book. One thing I did not say yesterday, because we were already, digressing away from the discussion so many times, but do you remember the creation of the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission?
Yeah.
What did that come as a result of? No, this is in 1964. It's part
of the Civil Rights Act.
In addition to making it illegal to discriminate in private-owned businesses, it creates this EEOC. So it's a government agency to protect and to examine and go into. If, like the Wagner Act, went around looking for where business abuses labor to protect labor, this is a government agency that goes around looking to see where racism is being practiced, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. So it's,
and they can just sue the Soviet Army over their language policy.
Yeah. But the reason I thought it was ironic is, who replaced Thurgood Marshall as the justice on the court? And Clarence Thomas is,
what?
In addition to being black, he is politically Republican conservative, and has throughout his life maintained that his advancements were due to his own efforts, not affirmative action. Which, if you look at the history of how he got into school and got the jobs, etc., it's not fully the case. So he doesn't give a lot of credit to being given preferences in his hiring. He maintains that it's all his own individual earnings. But while he was head of the EEOC in the Reagan years, what controversy arose? This could be on the AP test too. What controversy arose during his confirmation hearings? You don't know this? You're going to make me have to embarrassingly explain the whole thing? Well, while he was being questioned about his positions on issues, and this is interesting too, because you ever heard of Robert Bork?
Mm-hmm.
Robert Bork was a Reagan appointee in the early 80s who was way right-wing conservative and had a paper trail of writings and essays that showed it, arguing such things as there is no right of privacy in the Constitution, that is an add-on judicial activist interpretation. he was very, very
healing stuff for the confirmation.
And because of his ideas, a democratically dominated Senate rejected him, just flat out rejected his nomination. And if I remember correctly, Reagan tried two or three times to hint and suggest that he should withdraw himself like Harriet Myers did because of the fight that was coming, and he wouldn't do it. He hung in there until they finally just voted him out, voted him down. And there was a Saturday Night Live skit where, did anybody see that? I'm really digressing, but this will get back to the point. Let me see the Untouchable movies with Kevin Costner.
Directed by Brian De Palma.
Okay. Who played
Kevin Costner?
No, the bad guy, Italian mobster that everybody knows. Al Capone?
Robert De Niro.
De Niro plays Capone, and there's a scene where he's walking around mentioning how unhappy he is that somebody's unloyal. He's got a baseball bat in his hand.
Yeah, are you going to describe that scene?
Okay, so what happens in the scene?
So you can describe it.
Well, after he hints pretty firmly who it is and stands behind the guy and talks about how bad it is for the organization to be unloyal, he beats him to death with the baseball bat in front of everybody at the dinner table. Saturday Night Live did a skit in the early 80s where Reagan's walking around the table full of people and there's Bork sitting there. He's talking about some people just don't understand what it means to protect the team. This team, you know, starts beating Bork with the bat. Yeah, I had that. So that set the example that if you're not going to get confirmed, you should voluntarily step back out and withdraw your nomination rather than embarrass the president like Harriet Myers did. Now, where I'm going with all this is, because Bork didn't get confirmed by having too many well-defined views and ideas, that and to be Borked, so to speak, is to be rejected because you have a paper trail behind you. The pattern began that nominees now try their best to have no evidence of where they stand on any issue.
Or they just don't answer the question.
Right. What was Roberts' tricks on answering there?
What was it? Have you seen the, or had, did you like the movie Casablanca? He's like, some say it's a good movie.
People were so reluctant.
They couldn't get anything out of them.
Yeah, they don't want him to be giving
it. Was it Daschle, or who's, do they have a Daschle still in office? Was
answering him the questions? I don't know. But what I'm getting at is that...
Teddy Kennedy's on the Judiciary Committee.
Yes, that it set a pattern after Bork that you don't tip your hand where you stand, especially on abortion or other issues, because you may not get confirmed.
Well, they say that they may have to excuse themselves from a future case if they answer that question.
So, watching what happened to Bork, when Thurgood Marshall in 91 stepped down and was replaced with Thomas... He went into the training he was given, and that is, I don't have an opinion, I'm not familiar with that case, I just can't say until such a case came before me. It the classic answers, and so in disgust, I think it was Patrick Leahy, who just got so impatient with Clarence Thomas, started asking his opinions on cases, and answer after answer, I'm not familiar with that case, and finally said, what's your opinion on Dred Scott? I'm not familiar with that case, came the answer from Clarence Thomas. Which Bush, when asked about his nominee, said, best man for the job. But that still isn't where I'm going with the story. In the middle...
He does it in American history, he's the best man for the job.
Cool Bush story on that, too. But where I'm going with this is, in the middle of that mess, then came forward Anita Hill, and this is where it could be on the AP test. I wish we had time for it. But it's true history, we'll just have to go with it. Yeah, let them hear. Anita Hill is an African-American... law professor from the University of Oklahoma who had worked at one time in the EEOC under Thomas during the Reagan years. And here he was being championed as the leader of a civil rights commission, African American who'd done well by himself, been a solicitor general prior to this. She claims while she was an employee at the EEOC that he had sexually harassed her on repeated occasions. So they started asking her, well, can you give us evidence? These are, you know, bold accusations. That's not fair to say these things without evidence. What did he do? So do you want to hear the stories? According to her, he would come in and talk about the various porno films he'd watched the night before, such as his favorite, Long Dong Silver.
And then there was all, Clarence Thomas?
Yeah, this is what she claimed he said. Then there was also... He would leave a Coke can there and say, gee, what is that we see on the Coke can? Is that a pubic hair in my Coke can?
I don't know that. Okay.
Yeah. And there were other accusations and statements and repeated comments to the point that she finally quit. And so then all the question came up, if she was harassed by him, why didn't she say something at the time about it? Seems like this is way after the fact for us to first ever hear about these events. And, of course, what is the answer that's often given in that situation?
Fear of reprisals.
And it was best just to leave rather than make an incident of the time. So then women's rights groups came forward arguing this is so classic that women get harassed but then in a male-dominated world have nowhere to turn. And here's another example of a case that occurred that never got justice like it should have. Are we going to confirm this guy on the Supreme Court?
Yeah.
Well, then it was a he said, she said thing. And he argued that she had been put up to it by the liberals and this was nothing more than a high-tech lynching of an uppity Negro. And that was the fight.
The one that doesn't know what Dred Scott is.
A liberal?
He's saying that the liberal Democrats are engaged in a high-tech lynching of an uppity Negro trying to get a job. Well, he made it anyway. He got confirmed, but it was with that cloud that hung over him for years about, you mentioned Anita Hill, and everybody kind of rolled their eyes. Well, Republicans said that the only reason they went after him is because they're liberals, and that when their own liberals start abusing women, they'll sit on their hands and keep their mouths shut. And sure enough, what happened when the whole Clinton womanizing thing came out? Conservative women came out and said, where's those liberal groups that complained about Clarence Thomas? Why aren't they complaining about Clinton now? Now they support Clinton and look the other way.
He's Clinton.
He's Clinton.
But I have to give to the conservatives. At least they abandoned Bush when he touched Social Security.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember a skit in Saturday Night Live by the best guy who was ever on Saturday Night Live at all, the one that the wife killed him? Phil Hartman. He was doing Clinton. And this is the, like, right when he first became president. And he's jogging with Secret Service men, and he comes into a fast food restaurant.
Oh, and starts eating the sandwich.
Yeah, and he's answering people's questions, but he's eating everybody's food while he's at it, emphasizing how overweight Clinton. He was the second heaviest president in history, right after Taft. And at one of the points where he's eating the French fries and answering difficult questions about foreign policy and economic formula, and making comparisons about the food and the issues, one of the Secret Service men said, you know, well, I don't think you should be staying here so long. Mrs. Clinton doesn't know you've stopped in here. To which he replies, and this is early on, there's going to be a lot of things Mrs. Clinton's not going to know about in this administration. And that was like...
Was this after Whitewater?
First year, 93.
Was this after Whitewater?
Well before it. It was well before all those things came up.
Well, who is doing SNL research? Was
Al Franken?
Yeah, Al Franken was one of the writers for a long time.
But weren't there some... Didn't the actual events that he's accused of Whitewater occur before this?
Well, Whitewater occurred in Arkansas before that, but it wasn't revealed until like 94, 95.
Yeah, but could a researcher have found information about it?
Only Al Franken.
Were there papers filed or anything?
That was kind of just, you know, when you can observe into the future. Well, one other thing. Let me read this to this. This is following Wallace's... refusing to let students enter the University of Alabama in 63. It says, throughout the Deep South, traditionalists remained steadfast in the fall of 63. Wallace dramatically stood in the doorway of the building of the University of Alabama to block the enrollment of several black students, but stepped aside in the face of insistent federal marshals. And that's the Forrest Gump scene where he picks up the book for the girl. That night, President Kennedy spoke eloquently of the moral issue facing the nation. If an American, because of his skin is black, cannot enjoy the full and free life which all of us want, then who among us would be content to have the color of the skin changed and stand in his place? Who among us would be content with the counsels of patience and delay? Later that night, so apparently that same night that Kennedy made that speech following the Alabama incident, this is in 63, NAACP official Medgar Evers was shot to death as he returned home in Jackson, Mississippi. So his killing appears on there. And somewhere in here, it is 2 weeks later. I'm mixing things up. In August of 63 is the Poor People's March on Washington, in which King delivers a speech which includes the lines, I say to you today, my friends, that in spite of the difficulties and frustrations of the moment, I still have a dream. It's a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day the sons of former slaves and sons of former slave owners will be able to sit together at the table of brotherhood. 2 weeks later, a bomb exploded in a Birmingham church, killing four black girls who arrived early for the Sunday services. So those are all events that I found would be useful in the discussion. So it's still not well organized, but get your civil rights events year by year organized, and what leads to what organizations are involved in what. And I think the theme that they like to ask you to address is, what were the various differing views and movements that existed in the civil rights movement? So there's the SCLC, SNCC, and CORE in the beginning. And then later, when King the movement has achieved the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act of 62 and 65, then there is this militant breakaway. I'm going to say some breakaway. It's this militant insistence to not cooperate with white society, to be separatist and defensive among the Nation of Islam and the Panther movement and the more militant SNCC movement.
Do you know what civil rights sounds like?
Say.
Silver rights.
The way I say it?
No. Just the way you say it, like anyone says it. And they're both the poor person trying to...
So Civil rights, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we're going, is this going to lead us into the urban riots?
Yes, it is. Yeah. That's where I was going with that. So you have those pages in the Tyndale book if you want to look back over and get that more clearly. The urban riots of 64, in fact, they mentioned that, that right after the Voting Rights Act of 65, right within days after it, or weeks, I think, within days almost, the first major riot occurs in Watts, California, Watts, Los Angeles.
What number?
Number 26. In the summer of 66 and 67, in major northern cities in the summer, riots break out. Detroit's riot in 67 being so bad that army tanks had to be brought in to quell the rioting, which was put all over the news in the Soviet Union as saying that capitalist racism eventually turns to military suppression of their own people. Capitalists who oppress the working class cannot treat their minorities as equal and must use the military to suppress their desires for justice.
It's true.
That's true.
It's hypocritical, but true.
As though they had clean hands themselves. There, but, yeah, it's Prague's just the very next year after that.
I believe I've seen a couple of pictures of the paint.
Well, here's the question that arises. If civil rights laws are achieved in 64, and if voting rights are achieved in 65, these are landmark major accomplishments that should have been accomplished through the 14th and 15th Amendment exactly 100 years earlier. So finally, 100 years later, the achievement of legislated, re-legislated, court-protected civil rights and voting has come about. Why do these people, I'll put it this way, go into riot mode and start burning down not Korean parts of town or white parts of town, their own parts of town, start burning and destroying their own property?
Economic disparity.
That's what it is. Yeah. Previous riots had usually been white on black. This was black on black. In fact, it said in the book there that when firemen came to try to put out the fires in these areas that were where the riots were taking place, people up in the buildings threw bricks at the fire persons who were trying to put out the fire of their own homes. So what if before we even get into explaining why it happened, or surmising why it may have happened,
get the government to rebuild it all better.
How did Billy Joe Bob, white guy in Montana who's never seen a black person, think about all this on the news?
Can we just get them civil rights?
Yeah, that they have no appreciation. What do they want? They just got civil rights, they got voting rights, and now they're burning down their own city. It resulted in a loss of enthusiasm by middle America to pursue further civil rights. That's where those riots really, as well as the diversion of attention to Vietnam, starts to really take people's focus off what else do they need, what else do they want. But the real explanation is what you're going with, and what's that?
And that's how we started.
Yeah, it's one thing to finally have the right to buy a Mercedes. It's another thing to ever really get a job that will pay well enough to be able to buy one. So it's a case of high expectations which meet with diminishing real returns. Another explanation has it that the programs that had created opportunity began to allow black middle class people to do better but leave. So what you had left in the inner cities in lots of occasions were not the people who had been benefited by these new programs, but the people who were at the bottom of the ladder and seemed even more hopeless and more despairing as the community income and investment potential disappeared.
Didn't you see kind of the same thing after the desegregation and defense plans under FDR? The blockbusting? The white flight?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. The white flight out of those communities is exactly what happened with the upper middle class black flight out of the ghetto areas. And so therefore it is that economic disparity and hopelessness which seemed to be the cause. And also in the hot summers with nothing to do, angry people becoming a little more empowered and angry and but frustrated at the same time did result in that action. And it's in that period also that King is killed in 68, and we'll see in number 27. But you can imagine the impact on white opinion that may have been sympathetic to what happened while watching Birmingham take place or Selma take place. That enthusiasm or that kind of support starts to dwindle after the riots take place. I'll read this to you because this could come up. It says, a special commission on civil disorders, which they don't give the name to, but I'll tell you it's called the Kerner Commission, K-E-R-N-E-R, conducted by Ohio Governor Otto Kerner. The Kerner Commission noted that, unlike earlier race riots, the urban upheavals of the middle 60s were initiated by black themselves. Earlier riots had been started by whites, which had provoked black counterattacks. Now blacks visited violence and destruction on themselves in an effort to destroy what they could not stomach and what civil rights legislation seemed unable to change.
How do you spell Kerner?
K-E-R-N-E-R. And the Kerner Commission, which it doesn't say here, made the comment that what these riots show is that we're becoming a country ever more separate and ever more unequal, and that the government should take much greater decisive steps to try to ameliorate the discrepancy of poverty between the races, meaning more social programs, affirmative action, etc. So if you were Billy Joe Bob again, how would you feel after we gave them civil rights and we gave them the right to vote, like it came out of nowhere in the last century?
Or like if they ever technically lost them? They're just deprived of them by the government for a limited period of time.
After we gave them this, they have no appreciation but to burn down their own communities. So therefore, we should be giving them more job programs and redistribute more of my tax dollars to help them. You can imagine what impact the Kerner Commission suggestions had on some people's attitudes. Let me read this to you here. This is something that needs to be read straight out of Tyndall. By 66, black power had become the new rallying cry. Radical members of the SNCC had become estranged from King's theories of militant nonviolence. As King became the center of attention from the white media, SNCC members began to refer to him cynically as Delawd, D-E-L-A-W-D. When Stokely Carmichael, a 25-year-old graduate of Howard University, became head of SNCC in May of 66, the separatist philosophy of black power became official, and whites were ousted from the organization. We reject an American dream defined by white people and must work to construct an American reality defined only by Afro-Americans, said a SNCC position paper. H. Rapp Brown, who followed Carmichael as head of SNCC in 67, even urged blacks to get you some guns and kill the honkies. Meanwhile, Carmichael...
Is that quotes?
Yeah.
Now, Carmichael's not the one that graduated. Which one's the one that graduated from whatever university?
Carmichael, it said, came from Howard University. Brown, it doesn't say where he came from.
Brown was in charge.
Following Carmichael.
Oh, okay. Following Carmichael?
Yeah.
Apparently he's the one that said, get you some guns and kill some hobbies.
That's right. So you can see that doesn't sound like the King nonviolence.
They still call themselves the Student Nonviolent Court.
I thought that was a bit ironic. Stokely Carmichael, it says in here, would later go off and become a member of the Black Panther Party movement. And there is, he changes his name. Trying to get the name change here for you. Close. It is in that spirit. Served as chairman of the Student Nonviolent Accordion Committee in the mid-60s, was a leading member of the Black Panthers, took the name Kwame Ture in 1968, died in 1998. That was Carmichael. And when it comes to speaking of Panthers, and let's do that, let's jump from 26 to 28 and we'll come back to the assassination of King. While Carmichael became a prominent member, he's not one of the founding leaders, and the founding leader members are Huey P. Newton, Bobby Seale, and Eldridge Cleaver. And what was the Panther movement?
Radical movement,
Chicago.
It's Oakland's where it started, but it had branches in Chicago and elsewhere. But Oakland, California, is its origin point. Can you give me a visual image of them? Yes. Speaking of that, you know where that first got big? I mean, that's Black Power symbol had been around for quite a while, but where did it first get its historic impact?
The Olympics.
Olympics in Mexico.
They were given their medals back. Recently.
They were told not to express any kind of militant political black idealism because they're members of the Olympics team, not a black activist group. But when they received the, bronze, silver, and gold, all three, wasn't it?
No, there's a white guy in the picture.
They did the black car symbol in that really frustrated and upset the Olympic Committee.
How can the Olympic Committee really say that not with the black car?
Because that is how
the Olympics is not America. It's freedom of speech.
Yeah, that was how controversial the civil rights movement was in the mid-60s. It would be like if somebody, had Bong Hits for Jesus t-shirt on across the street from school or something.
No, except it wasn't a t-shirt, it was a gigantic banner.
Okay, well.
Well, what is that?
I think that's a little different.
It is a little different, but I mean.
It'd be someone like grant mass citizenship to all Mexicans.
Yeah, that'd be a good parallel. It'd be like if someone who advocated doing some drastic gains for the illegal immigrant community. That's the way you kind of think.
Well, is that in addition to what they're already doing in California?
Here's a waste of our time that's valuable. The first time we were on TV as a quiz bowl team, my son had one of these little Transformer toys, and one of them was real dark blue, dark black colored, and when you moved it around, and we had one where he could put his arm up in the air, he looked just like the Olympic guy. So we put that on TV when we first got on TV and played.
Could you see it actually on the TV?
If you look back at the old tapes, there's this little Transformer doing the black power stuff.
Did you ever catch that?
I was proud of that.
Has he ever come up to you and told you how racist you are?
No. Why did I get into that, though?
You were talking about the founders of...
Oh, the image. What's the image? The image of the black power symbol. What other images go with this?
And then we're like black berets.
Yes, berets.
Black turtlenecks.
Yes, black turtlenecks. Black underpants. Sunglasses.
Black pants. And
yeah, and it was started by Vietnam veterans with weapons skills. And what was the image and what did they want to portray?
Militant revolutionary radicals.
Yes, the militant revolutionary radicals are going to defend the black community from white intimidation. No longer will we be picked on by white society. We'll fight back and defend our interests. Of course, what signal does that send white community?
They're scared.
Yeah, that they themselves are going to be the aggressive, dangerous people. So you can see where the Panther movement and Nation of Islam, we haven't really gone into that yet, but its attitudes were perceived to be also not as amenable to getting along with white society. The separatist thinking is evident in both movements. The idea that you can't get along with white society. White society will not protect your interests. You're always weak if you depend on white society. You need to be actually, in many ways, it's almost the Klan coming from another direction. The only hope is to be separate. The only hope is to keep the two communities of member mixing.
Garvey still in Caribbean at this point?
He's probably dead by now, because if he was deported in the late 20s, and this is 40 years after the fact. I don't know, but I would bet he's long gone. What I did find about Eisenhower, not the quote I was talking about, was when Eisenhower was his kind of like naive attitudes towards race, they asked him why he never made any efforts during the civil rights efforts of the 50s to meet with and talk to black community leaders. His response was, to be fair, I'd have to talk to the Klan, too. So he equated all civil rights leaders, and like King in the 50s, he speaks to them, he's very curious to talk to the Klan leaders. Wow. That's a naive view of things. More about these people. Newton died.
Did you ever talk about the Soviet response to the...
The Soviet response was to propagandize how in America we treat our races so unfairly that they riot and destroy and burn cities and have to be suppressed by the military.
Oh.
Which, as you said, was true in this case.
What is the
Tiananmen Square?
Tiananmen Square?
Hungary.
Is that the one with the guy standing out in front of the
tank?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's on a roadway off Tiananmen Square.
I think I read somewhere that guy was later incarcerated or executed.
Executed.
Okay. They didn't just run him down with the tank?
Not at that time. There was too much publicity on the attention. Now, the night,
Ministry of State Security got him later.
The night before, though, is when they had rolled through and killed like 2,000 or 3,000 demonstrators in Tiananmen Square with tanks and other machinery when the media was not focused watching it.
They ran over people then?
Mm-hmm. You know, when that happened in 1989, I think it was, I was teaching a summer course, but the first time I taught morning summers at UFIS or West Ark at the time, and I was bringing up, you know, how what it meant to us to see a papier-mâché Statue of Liberty erected in Tiananmen Square for Chinese youth to be protesting their own communist government, hearkening to American liberties. And I had taped a quote by some Chinese student who was demanding that their country adopt similar things to the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence. And the English was very stilted and incorrect, but it was touching, you know, there was someone speaking in broken English trying to capture the ideals of America in the middle of communist China. And as I played that, I expected, you know, kind of like tears to flow and people to feel patriotic and proud of their own country. And some rednecky girl up front said, you know, they can't even speak our language correctly.
So that's beyond redneck level bigotry.
Slappers.
Dumbass is what I would call it.
Did you jump down and slap a face?
Did you find a very heavy book?
The rolled eyes of all the rest of the class pretty well did it for me. More on these people here. Newton.
Is she getting jumped after class?
I think it wouldn't jump after.
You mean that in a mean spirited way, not in a.
Yeah.
Someone, well, mean. She's hot. She's as bigoted mean. As me. Yeah. She didn't mean that part. Okay, sorry. Huey Newton died a couple of years ago from drug overdose.
Baby Huey? Not even related, is
it? Not a founding member of the Black Panthers.
It's by the Ducks, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a.
The Donald Duck family member.
I thought Huey Newton got shot.
Did he?
No.
It was, but he met a sudden non-natural death here just a couple of years ago.
Was there a dude named Huey that got shot 3 times in the dark?
I don't know.
Maybe Long?
Eldridge Cleaver, whose autobiography was Soul on Ice, if he's still alive in the last decade, what he's made a lot of his money on was cookbooks. Soul cookbooks. Cooking with soul, cooking with, you know, the community. And he did quite well with it.
Kind of about capitalizing on the whole Black Panther thing?
George Foreman Grill thing.
It's not. I just had a funny time.
And then, but the one who I find the most fascinating, because this alludes to some future history we'll talk about, is Bobby Seale. Has anybody ever heard of the Chicago 8, which became the Chicago 7? Well, in 1968, and we'll go into greater details about this when we get there, in 1968, during the Democratic Convention, in which that's the going into that convention is where Robert Kennedy had won most of the primaries, but then was killed in California before the convention. So the party ends up nominating Hubert Humphrey, who entered no primaries, and the rules didn't demand it yet. So there was this era of kind of like backroom hack politician corruption within the party that the people out winning primaries, either don't get the nomination or were killed getting there, and that Humphrey, who was quite liberal himself as a politician, got branded as being the machine politician party nominee. And so there's lots of demonstrations and arguments inside the convention. On the outside of the convention, 10,000 war protesters showed up in Chicago to protest why the Democratic Party was not still getting us out of Vietnam. And when those protesters tried to find a place to crash the first night, there weren't enough hotel rooms, they were all going to sleep in the parks, and the police made a decision under Daley, Richard Daley, the mayor, yes? He was shot?
He was shot in the dark in 1989.
Oh, 89, I thought it was more recent than that. But anyway, the police refused to let him sleep in the parks, so when they got into the parks and tried to bed down, the police started shoving him out, and a police riot occurred in the sense of how they beat up on people. And people like Dan Rather went down with cameras to cover it, and they beat up Dan Rather and others, and of course that all got put on television. So the and similar events started to happen inside the convention
was
hall
Ted
also.
Was Ted Koppel involved with that?
I don't know.
Is this where Dan Rather gets knocked down?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the press covers the police riots that were conducted outside and inside the convention hall, and it becomes a disaster for the Democratic Party. Well, following all this, 8 people were arrested for crossing state lines to incite a riot. They include such names as Jerry Rubin, that zany guy. See, he had effing Nom in Forrest Gump. What's that guy's name?
Who is that guy?
He wrote Steal This Book. And then his autobiography was seen to be made a major motion picture. I can't believe I'm forgetting this guy. You know what I'm talking about.
No, I never knew who that guy was before.
What? We needed another author.
Who's the guy? Abbie Hoffman.
Okay.
You've heard of Abbie Hoffman. Abbie Hoffman was one of the Chicago 8. Crazy guy, really. When he died in the mid-80s, he was wearing, when they found him in bed, dead, he was wearing a t-shirt that said, this is kind of fitting of the fears of what Reagan might do in Nicaragua. My country invaded Nicaragua and all I got was this lousy t-shirt. That's Abbie Hoffman was very good at him. But Hoffman, Reuben, Dillinger, Hayden, Tom Hayden, former husband of Jane Fonda.
And who?
Jane Fonda's former husband.
Who's that?
Tom Hayden. Founder of the SDS, Students for Democratic Society.
You know what they describe Mark Nicholson? A Marxist.
That's not surprising. I can see that. Do you mind doing a little further research for Chicago 8? Give us the background of Chicago 8. One of them is Bobby Seale.
There's someone trying to get the YDA chapter restarted at UFIS.
No one's talked about it. And when they went on trial, Seale said, I refuse to be represented in this trial by white lawyers and white society in front of a white judge. This is a corrupt society. I'm not getting fair justice. And I demand a separate trial and separate lawyer. And the answer is pretty much shut up and sit down. And he wouldn't do it, so they finally chained him to the chair. And then he wouldn't shut up, so then they gagged him. So
why didn't they just hold him in contempt?
Oh, that was long after the in contempt.
But, I mean, when you're held...
You still have to appear before trial.
You want the members?
Yeah, the members and their little ditties of history there. And so then while chained in the chair and gagged, he would fall over on the floor and roll around and kick and scream, and or try to scream and kick things in the floor. So they finally dragged him off and had a separate trial for him.
Isn't that cruel and unusual punishment, even before being convicted of something?
Of course.
Abbie Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, David Dillinger, Tom Hayden, Lenny Davis, John Freund, Wayne Wiener, Ryder.
Yep, that's our Chicago 8, then Chicago 7.
Why did it become Chicago 7?
Because Bobby Seale was dragged off and given a different trial because he wouldn't be 8.
Oh, okay. Now he's the one that nominated for.
That one is gagged in the courtroom.
This is when I was in high school. This is what I was watching. Watched that convention and all that stuff. I thought, wow, I want to be a history teacher. I want to teach all this stuff.
Didn't they go into the convention and protesting and throwing out?
Their main protest was in the convention was to these guys never got in the convention, but the people who did protest in the convention argued, one, against the way Humphrey got the nomination without winning primaries, two, that the party was still in Vietnam.
And what year was this?
68.
So what are we going to do after the AP test?
Watch all kinds of cool videos, though.
Yeah.
So can you imagine that the mood, the climate and the mood in America in 1968 when Vietnam has started to stagnate, we're stuck in Vietnam like we are in Iraq, and if you try to get out, you're considered unpatriotic, but if you stay, then just people die with no seeming answer to get out. Civil rights seems to have soured and turned into these more militant movements.
Well, there's civil rights going on right now.
Right now?
For Mexican
immigrants. Yeah. Well, there might be some parallel times here. It's just not as charged and radical now, though, as it was then.
Well, it's because
it's kind of charged in that
you
the cities are disobeying federal law.
You can't be out in public if you can be deported.
Well,
except the federal government doesn't actually...
What and also what?
And the law cities have
what is
the laws that they
can't sure
write.
Cultural climate, the music of the times in 67, 68. It's the hippie movement. It's the radical musical changes. So, Hendrix music. You know, so you can imagine what did traditional older generation white society feel about America in 1968?
Way too liberal
and crap.
Yeah. So that all these things contribute to that movie.
And that was Seale who got tried separately.
Yes. Uh huh. And he's 29. Well, let's go back to 27. April of 1968, King, while assisting a garbage worker strike in Memphis, is assassinated. The person who is accused and convicted and jailed is incarcerated is James Earl Ray. The But shortly after the conviction, the King family began to doubt whether he truly was guilty. And years later, they put up a lot of money and time and effort to try to prove that James Earl Ray was framed and that the real killer had never been caught. And Ray died in prison 5, 6, 7 years ago. And the family still to this day, the members of the family left, still maintain that Ray was falsely convicted.
Did Ray maintain his innocence?
I don't know. We could look it up and see.
I was about to say,
so,
pretty soon it'll just be Wicca education degree.
So did the garbage strike lead to those riots in 100 cities, or did it assassinate?
Yes. Well, not the strike, but the killing of King.
When that happened after?
It should have said, garbage strike, comma, King's death leads to riots in over 100 cities. One of the things that helped ameliorate the riots and could have toned them down somewhat was Robert Kennedy, who was really well respected and loved by the black community because he seemed to be the politician in the Democratic Party most protective of their interests and was going to be the presidential candidate. Yeah, that would protect their interests. He made a speech in which he wanted people to try their best to be forgiving, that he knows what it's like to have one of their own killed by a white man, his own brother was. So he did well.
And he was.
And then later he is too. So,
well,
so that can be, that also
was that a white guy or was that a
Arab?
Yeah.
So that, if you can think about it, the killing of King, well, first Kennedy in 63, then King in 68, then Robert Kennedy in 68. 68 is such a tumultuous year, and that's what we meant by this idea that the idealism of the early 60s. Early 60s is still fun-loving 50s. Beach Boys music. Choop Choop songs, beach parties, fun, everything. And then all of a sudden we have the confrontation of the civil rights movement, the Vietnam conflict, and then...
When did the Charles Manson thing?
69, in this period.
And then Malcolm X was assassinated in 65.
Mm-hmm. Let's move into that. Let's move that to number 30. Elijah Muhammad. In 1930... Elijah Poole was his original name. Did you find anything?
He said that he didn't do it, but he may have been partially responsible.
He said that about himself?
Without knowing it.
Partially responsible.
Is he a conspiracy or something? And then he escapes prison?
I remember when he escaped prison.
And then he came back?
Yeah, they came.
And then he got stabbed?
Yeah, I remember this.
And then he contracted hepatitis C and died.
That's what did it, huh? So maybe partially responsible. That's almost not a thing. I may actually be drinking illegal Oklahoma untaxed beer. Maybe partially responsible.
Are you?
He has an alibi. When he was going to Canada or something.
These are wild stories. Elijah Poole, 1930, establishes the Nation of Islam. It is truly a Muslim faith organization, but it has always an extra agenda at work here. Why would black people want to, aside from just complete theological reasons, want to move to Islam away from Christianity?
It is the
slave man, the slave driver forced Christianity upon our generations, but prior to being enslaved and having this religion put upon us, we originally, our ancestors were Islamic, and most were. Most of the people who were captured slaves were Muslim believers in those parts of Africa. So this, in many ways, is a getting back to one's heritage roots of race as well as religion. And that was the reason Muhammad organized. But then the movement continued to emphasize black identity, black citizenship, as well as religion. So that's where the movement always went. It wasn't just a, let's get back to our roots because they were Muslim. It was, let's continue to emphasize blackness, black identity. Are there other religions like that in America where you're as, that's what I'm thinking, that you're a member of the faith as much for religious for racial identity as you are for theological reasons?
That's a Muslim offshoot, sort of.
Well, I'm thinking some certain white Christian groups tend to be the ones that are way too extreme right wing for their own
church. French Davidians?
Yeah, something of that nature. So I'm not trying to paint up the Nation of Islam as being...
They have a
minority. The evangelical people?
Yeah.
T- To some degree, this is not fair, but I'm going to say this. I noticed this is not much strong now, but when the Vietnamese immigrants first came, there was lots of efforts to establish separate Vietnamese Baptist churches with the intent of keeping the Vietnamese language and culture and heritage alive as well as Christianity, separate from regular white churches, which would not protect that. Not the same thing, but you can see where the vein of where that's going. And then, of course, the most prominent, important person to join the movement would be Malcolm Little, the Detroit Red, as he originally called. Joined in the late 40s, early 50s, I think.
Yeah, but they went on Hajj and got killed.
After he got back.
Yeah.
And Malcolm Little changed his name to Malcolm X, and the X meaning what?
Yeah,
it's the missing African name they'll never know. Louis Farrakhan's Louis X, too, isn't he?
Interview with him, and I don't know who the guy who was interviewing was, some white guy, and he was like that. He kept trying to get Malcolm to say Little.
Mm-hmm.
He kept trying to.
He wouldn't say his own original name.
He was like, no, I don't even acknowledge that I have a name because that's a white name.
That's in keeping with the attitude.
I think it's those interviews that people see of Malcolm X, though, it's most of them are before he changes his entire belief, so he seems really extreme, so that's something that I need now.
You know who was hired as a ghostwriter to write his autobiography?
Alex Haley.
Yep. And what's Haley remembered for?
The Roots.
Have you seen any of the Roots video things?
I listened to all their albums. I didn't know that.
Roots as a video thing is really, really good. It's really educational. The first of the miniseries on TV, I think, come out, and it came out when I was in my second year teaching at Darby in 76, 77. And I learned much about black history both before and after the Civil War because there was a second part that I thought was even more useful than the first. It never got as much showing of popularity, called Roots, the Next Generation, in which it went from the 1870s up to all the way up to James Earl Jones playing Alex Haley, going back and finding his ancestors in Africa. So most of your 20th century civil rights black history stuff is put into that video real well.
You ever seen Bring Us Back?
I did. I didn't ever finish it. I just was really bothered by it.
I know it's got an important message.
I've never heard of it.
I've never seen the end. I was too bothered before I got there.
The movie with the curb
stomp.
That's what did it. I just...
You can just make it past that.
If you make it past that, I
stayed up till nearly 2 or 3 last night watching something that I've watched before, but it had a bigger impact on me last night than ever before, although every time I watch it has a bigger impact. Something I would like to show, but I will not show because of the violence, is Glory. Have you seen Glory? But seeing it at the campfire the night before they attacked.
Matthew Broderick, right?
Yes. It's just another reason why Denzel Washington is such a good actor.
You're talking about the feet or the shoe thing?
When they're after there's been so much clash between and among them, and finally they're all kind of giving their final song stories of their lives before they die the next day. But it seems like the only way they could find dignity as people is to have to go into a cause and die. And I was just thinking, well, shouldn't people be able to find reasons to live and dignity without having to be dying for it? Although when they were charging that Ford, I was thinking to myself, this is odd for me to say this, I shouldn't say it on tape, but I don't really see a justification for fighting to make the South stay in the Union. Is that wrong? I mean, I'm glad that slavery was abolished, and I'm glad the North won, but I've always felt like if you have to go to war to force people to stay with you when they don't want to, there's something fundamentally wrong with that thinking.
Yeah, if you think about it, without the Civil War, you'd have changed the entire course of world history.
Oh, for sure.
World War II, World War One.
Well,
I can understand where you're coming from.
Yeah, it just, if they struck first and you're defending yourself from an attack, that's one thing, but when you invade a place to make them follow the law.
Isn't that a fort?
Some
get all up in our fort hole.
Yeah, they did.
And what about all the people in the South that wanted to remain American?
It's no easy answer. that there's something. When Gorbachev did not go to war with all the new Soviet breakaway states, when he could have, for the same reason Lincoln did, and killed millions of Soviet citizens and didn't, he was praised for it. I thought he was right. And it was the end of the nation, too.
And see,
but the South,
they were born, everyone who lived in the South was born with rights through the Constitution, and then when they seceded, they no longer had those rights.
Well, the Southern Constitution
did. Right, and
have
I teach it that
rights.
Way.
So they took.
And I don't say in class what I just said, but.
They take the rights from our citizens, from the U.S. citizens. They take rights away that they didn't.
Well, the big thing about the
rights
difference between the
away?
Civil War and Gorbachev. Was if Gorbachev would have invaded those countries, he would be invading them to protect the tyranny of the Soviet Union.
So was this not to protect the tyranny of the Union government?
Yeah, but still you get the side path of slavery out of the Civil War. You don't get anything out of the.
Oh, I agree. The major byproduct is the free. But if, as we all studied, that was not Lincoln's purpose, and he probably would, if he could have gotten away with it, he would have avoided freeing the slaves just with the Union.
But that was with the intention that it was to be dissolved at some point in time, whereas the South could only.
But
it forever as a
the South and
how he got into it is he wouldn't allow slavery to grow. He could have compromised out of it if he just allowed it in the imaginary places.
But if half your family decides they want to move out, do you pull a gun on and say you're going to remain part of this union, this family?
Well,
if they key your car, do you justify, you know, everything else after that?
If they split the house in half with all that stuff on your side.
It's not an easy answer. Let's go back to the 1960s. But things were milder.
Then we wouldn't get out of. We didn't recognize our sovereignty, so we wouldn't remove the federal courts.
So
and if that were the case, every time a state interest was in the way.
You're right. That's the Lincoln argument. If they can secede, if they can hold their breath till they turn blue and threaten to get whatever they want when they don't win elections, you'll have no nation left.
Every single one just be watching.
That's correct. That's logically correct. I just don't want to kill on people.
Yeah. Yeah, actually
can you find out when Malcolm X joined the Nation of Islam? Is it late 50s?
Clarence 13 X joined in the late 60s.
Mr. Jones, it would actually be the People's Republic of Massachusetts.
That's true. In late 40s, I bet, because I know they was already involved in the mid 50s in an important that scene in the movie where they all stand out and refuse to leave until the person's given safe passage.
Also known as El Shabazz.
Yeah, because the daughter's got that last name.
Do you like
L or Al?
I do.
L.
It's not historically correct, but it captures the right spirit. When did he join?
1947,
48. When? Because he's a prominent member of the movement by mid-50s.
He went to meet Elijah Muhammad in 52.
Okay.
And changed his name to X.
What was the attitudes that the Nation of Islam had, started by Elijah Muhammad as well as carried on through support of Malcolm X? I think I have it here.
Militant taking of the rights that were.
Don't get help from white.
Yes, that's really what I wanted to stress. The most articulate spokesman for Black Power was one of the earliest, Malcolm X, formerly Malcolm Little, with the X denoting his lost African surname. Risen from a ghetto childhood of narcotics and crime to become the chief disciple of Elijah Muhammad, the black Muslim prophet who rejected Christianity as the religion of white devils. Yes, I'm an extremist, he acknowledged in 1964. The black race in the United States is in extremely bad shape. You show me a black man who isn't an extremist, and I'll show you one who needs psychiatric attention. That's still not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for that today. Self-help.
He also purported the value of religion, of religion, but also of education and all that.
Praising, or
he was really strong in purporting education, especially in like secondary level.
Well, there is much on the idea that you build your own communities, your own black businesses. You don't be dependent upon white society. But where we see the link is this separatist nationalist identity goes all the way back to Garvey. Where his father learned it also as an organizer for the Garvey movement. And it's fundamentally a doubt and a mistrust that white society can ever truly treat people as equal.
It was between 46 and 52.
I think it was in 46 when he was in prison for.
So that's when he first exposed
to it. Yeah, he exposed between when he has a sentence of 46 to 52.
It was while he was in jail because he went in 46 and was out in 52. And he converted at some point.
So if you had to write, say, The two essays you're given a choice is something you've never heard of whatsoever, like explain changes in monetary policy between 1912 and 1922, or trace the civil rights movement. So you're stuck having to write the civil rights essay. It's not a bad thing, but I'm just trying to say that if that's where you're going. How would you distinguish the Panthers and the Nation of Islam and SNCC as it became more changed in its thinking from the King's movement of SCLC?
They were decidedly not nonviolent and more militant and radical, more take the rights instead of work with the white community to pass civil rights protections.
And separatist rather than integrationist. Because with the court cases led by Thurgood Marshall in 54 and also King's, their notions is allowing black and white to be mixed equally. And the other, I think, is there's no value to the mixing. The other is, just, in some ways, on reverse reasons, it's like the Klan, that we're only better off if we stay away from that race.
So
that's strategic differences.
How did Warren deal with the black militant groups?
I don't know.
Just
the first part of it.
So you have integrationists and white supremacists?
That'd be the two different schools of thought. Are the integrationists suck up Uncle Tom's?
Not really. That's kind of the best way to generate equality is for integration.
We white people here sitting here all think this. But I think that's true too, that eventually harmony, well, we're all white, aren't we?
But you have to remember there's more white people.
Yeah, I think in the long run, any movement that preaches and continues to expound, you can never get along with somebody. And that's where I drew the line with Marxists. The idea that the capitalist bourgeois class is unsavable. They can never change, they can never share, they can never care about the poor. They're always going to be just the dirty, filthy rich that have to be expunged and gotten rid of. That kind of thinking on the Marxist part is not something I can stomach, and I think the same feeling I have about separatism. From the distrust that some given community will never come across. But then I'm just an idealistic hippie. By 1964, Malcolm had broken with Elijah Muhammad and founded his own organization, which was committed to the establishment of alliances between African Americans and non-white people. As we all know, this came after his trip to Mecca and realization. But just after the publication of the autobiography in 1965, Malcolm was gunned down in the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem by assassins who represented a rival faction of black Muslims, and many believe that they were working on the orders of Elijah Muhammad.
What did Malcolm X, what did he establish? What organization?
I don't have the name of it here, but it was a separate religious movement from the Nation of Islam. With him went the most effective voice for urban black militancy since Marcus Garvey.
Did Garth fled the Caribbean?
Was deported.
He was deported?
I don't think fled, to be correct.
Was he from the Caribbean?
That's like fleeing to DOC.
Was he? He was from Jamaica? Okay, I thought he was from
Yeah,
the West.
Originally, yeah. So 31, court case. Have we talked about this somewhat already? Earl Warren? The three areas that he adjudicated in was civil rights protection.
Protection of the accused.
Rights abuse and gerrymandering. And here are the cases.
And a little bit of privacy stuff with Griswold.
Seems like we've done this, didn't we?
We did. It's on the other sheets.
So bad about repeat.
When we did Brown versus Board, we also went into the rest of them.
Oh, okay. So what did Baker versus Carr do?
Baker versus Carr was the gerrymandering? No.
Yes.
Yeah, it was.
Said that courts can now have the right to intervene in gerrymandering redistricting.
We didn't do MAP.
So we may come to that. We'll look at that in a second. If courts did not have the authority prior to Baker versus Carr to involve themselves in gerrymandering, who did?
The states.
The states themselves. And what was the traditions of how redistricting or gerrymandering usually went?
They party in power redistrict so that the
same
racial thing. Groups that had would be able to elect more seats.
So the dominant party draws the lines so the voters are packed in such a way so they keep winning re-elections?
Yeah.
Traditionally, that only happened after a census report. You'd redraw after the new census report. Now they're getting to where parties in power do it year by year, creating a little more controversy. But Baker versus Carr's major purpose was to make sure that the courts had the authority to tell states you must redistrict on a fair parity method so that the larger populous areas get equal representation. since larger populous areas tended, they tended to be more ethnically mixed.
And the rocks and trees don't help politics?
Not as much, at least.
Not as much.
I'm thinking that the rest of these cases, of the other cases here, we don't need to do map. I've never seen map come up on the test.
What is map?
Government test. So we'll do it anyway. Map view, Ohio involved. I'm going to fall down on the floor here at this chair. Map view, Ohio involved an improperly obtained search warrant looking for gambling equipment and finding instead porn.
And then they threw out the conviction.
They threw out the conviction on the exclusionary rule, arguing that the warrant was not properly structured or put together, obtained. Now, if the warrant had been correct and they found something else besides what they were searching for, would that have been admissible evidence?
Only if they went and got another warrant for what they were searching.
No, actually, once you're in on a legal warrant, any other stuff that you find is admissible.
It is now?
Yeah, it has always been. So the exclusionary rule only works not on different evidence, but on improperly obtained warrants. Gideon versus Wayne. Put the wrong date, put the wrong address.
Or, if it doesn't specifically say yours to search the house, not just the car. If it says yours to search the car, then they can't search the house.
There are no more writs in the non.
Are you thinking writs of assistance?
Sure.
That was under the British in the Revolutionary War.
Right.
And that was the whole reasoning behind the warrants.
Threw me there for a second, yeah. There's not, that's the thing saying that you, Marshall, must. You, Madison, must send out the commissions to people like Marbury.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That's in the Tyndall book, right?
Yeah, that's why you threw me by mixing those together.
I'm doing poorly.
Gideon versus Wainwright, Miranda versus Arizona. Here's what those two things, they don't have anything in common, let's assume separate. Gideon versus Wainwright is where a person went to jail without ever having representation in court. He argued that he had his right to counsel denied. The court accepted his argument. He was able to be retried, and from that point on, it set the precedent that if you can't afford a lawyer, one will be appointed for you.
In state trials. Weren't they doing it in federal trials before then?
But I can move quickly on to the next item without looking like I know what I'm talking about.
That works.
Here we go. Miranda versus Arizona involves when arrested. The court deemed after that case that police must what?
Must read them their rights before they can ask questions.
Yeah, and one of those rights is to...
Remain silent.
Yes.
In Arkansas, you only have to do that if it's a felony, though. If it's a misdemeanor, they don't have to read the rights.
They're supposed to do that any time before they question you.
What happened to the old incorporation of the Fourth Amendment there?
Yeah, if they don't read you your rights and you start talking to them, I would seriously consider that in your appeal on your misdemeanor.
Chris Wall, you may be right. That sounds like...
No, but if it's a fine, think of all the law court costs, unless you want to call...
It doesn't matter. If you win, then I'm pretty sure they'll force the... You can get the state to pay the court costs.
Griswold versus Connecticut.
That's if you win, though.
By today's standards of decency, it sure will seem like an antiquated case, but Griswold versus Connecticut involved... The state of Connecticut had a law making it illegal for clinics to give anybody, even married people, birth control advice. But Planned Parenthood was still passing out information to parents who requested it.
Advice?
No, not contraception. It's just advice.
We talked about this. Yeah.
Did we?
Yeah.
Because I passed, on the way up to family yesterday, I passed Planned Parenthood.
Oh.
I
thought
of you.
Why would I have talked about this?
You talked about all these.
Oh, okay.
Except Matt versus Ohio.
But the Griswold case involved overturning the Connecticut law on what grounds?
Private, right?
Yeah. The right of private.
It's down the state of Connecticut.
And there's where I'm thinking it was. We were in the AP class trying to come up with... rights of private in the government class, trying to come up with rights of privacy cases. And the best one, of course, is Roe v. Wade. All the rest of them, especially involving sodomy cases, get way too embarrassing to talk about in class, and it's hard to have any evidence. But Griswold versus
Connecticut. You talk about Leonard versus Texas in class?
You can, but sometimes certain members of some classes become silly gigglers over such things.
Talk about me, I'm not mature enough to handle
it. No.
Sodomy is illegal in Arkansas.
Number 32, back to the Cold War. So Jones claims the South should have won and Slade should have stayed.
Well, not even homosexual. No, it doesn't
have to be homosexual. I know. Okay. Just all. Anything but.
Here's where I'm more comfortable. Item 32, foreign policy. Let's work our way back into foreign policy during the 60s, which will involve Latin America, Europe, and Cuba. That's Latin America. And Vietnam. How did Kennedy get elected?
He called some guy in Chicago and just...
Okay, yeah, that's true. I didn't mean the real answer. What I would,
he was able to rank in that corpse, though.
I heard something about...
Prior to the casting of the votes.
And he was the young dude.
Speaking of casting votes, remember the old Stalin expression?
Oh,
it's not important who casts the votes, but who counts the votes.
God, Stalin. Did he even try it?
Another Stalin phrase. If you're going to make an omelet, you got to crack a few eggs. But anyway.
What does that mean?
That means that's how he justified the murdering of 30 million Russians.
To make an omelet?
Yes.
To make a better Soviet Union.
But the omelet takes what's inside of those eggs.
But where I was going originally with all this was that
our arsenal.
He had to poach the egg with an ice pick in Mexico City.
And this is important. This is true during the Truman years, and it comes back again to be true during the Kennedy and Johnson years, and probably still haunting Carter and Clinton, and that is Democrats get painted after World War II as being the ones who are soft on communists. They're pacifists. They're liberals. They're probably kind of left-leaning and like big government programs like the Russians like anyway. So therefore, Republicans loom it over the Democrats, but they won't protect America against the communist threat. So Democrats, when they run for office, have to be even extra hawkish. And this explains Kerry's attitude, doesn't it? The Kerry behavior in the election? Even though he was the one with military service and Bush was not, how much more he had to act hawkish than Bush to try to warrant, to demonstrate that as a Democrat, I'm not a surrender monkey, I'm not going to cave in, because he's still fighting that old image of Democrats being soft on security. So that's why Kennedy made the comments about the missile gap. And after becoming president, he will continue to maintain this position of got to be tough on the Soviets and not give them an inch. Yes?
What were you saying about how he got elected?
By claiming that the Eisenhower administration had let our arsenal fall behind the Russians and we were in danger.
More specifically about Chicago or wherever it was?
That's the... It's a story that Cook County, Richard Daley, the mayor of Chicago.
Was there something about the mob involved in Kennedy getting elected?
People sometimes suspiciously suggest the mob may have been involved in the killing of Kennedy. He had friends who had friends in the mob, dated a mob while he was married to someone else, dated a mob chair.
Who did?
Kennedy.
Which one did
I don't know their name.
Which Kennedy?
John F.
Okay.
Jackson.
Something about Frank Sinatra helped him with California.
But I'm not so sure that will be the DBQ.
Probably.
That's what I'm trying to. In the remaining time that I'm losing and running out of, I'm
trying to
wind on.
That crap will be included in the documents.
But you know, what I have been saying, there could be someone who says Jones is so cynical. And it's true that I tend to be, I often interpret a president's policy or motivations built around how can they get reelected. And maybe that's not fair.
Yes, it is.
Is it possible that Kennedy wasn't putting on the heavy Cold War image just to get elected, but that he truly was someone who wanted to protect us from the Soviet threat? It's a mix of both, I think.
If that's the way you feel, do you love the first George Bush since he broke one of his promises?
I have lots of no problems with George the Elder. I have some problems with him, the way he won the election through destroying Dukakis' image from his campaign tactics. But in many ways, when you compare Reagan's administration, which he followed, and his son's administration, and even the Nixon administration prior to that, I put Ford and Bush the Elder in a far more humane camp than the other Republican presidents.
What time did you say you had to leave?
Okay, we'll get back here.
Let's ask him. How'd you say, please?
If I can get out of here by 3:30, I'll be safe.
Okay. It's 2:30.
Okay, and I could fudge a few minutes after that too, but I'm not sure when she comes in at the airport. But she can call me. Yeah. But you'll hear this lots of times. Republicans today will say that Democrats today are not like good old Democrats in the past. And what they mean by that was the Truman, Johnson, Kennedy, tough on communist foreign policy position.
That they're meaning the more on the lines of the Jefferson Davis Democrats?
No, they don't mean that far back. Although I have to stop to tell this story for a second. One day my son came, before he left for Oregon, worked as a textbooks manager at the university bookstore, and he would meet all kinds of people coming and going, especially those who delivered the books and the workers that come and go in the building. And he met this old man that he got to go drink beer with quite often, and the guy was bragging about the fact that he'd been a Democrat since the 1940s. And he said, in fact, I was a Democrat before we stopped being racist. That's what he told him. Neil told me that at the Red Lobster. I just nearly spit all my beer out and started laughing and couldn't stop. So historically interesting. But so JFK and LBJ's attitude, or at least the image they put forward, I think it's their attitude, was there is a monolithic... Wait, before I do this, one more thing. During the Truman turning into Eisenhower years, this is 40s into 50s, a debate arose... How are we going to cope with getting demobilized out of World War II but still being ready for the Cold War? We don't want to get into this permanent, exactly what Eisenhower would later say, military-industrial complex building. How can we afford to be protected against the Soviets, but we can't spend on the rate we did during World War II? We must get back to promoting a peacetime economy. So the first decision was we will avoid keeping a large conventional military and instead have only our defense be the nukes.
The deterrence policy?
Deterrence will be based on the cheap, more bang for the buck. Don't have as much ground forces as you would necessarily, or naval forces, instead put emphasis upon bombers and later missiles. But then as we got involved in Korea and in Vietnam and other things, it became where we needed both, and so the spending rose anyway. But at first that was part of the Eisenhower pledge, was that they would be more efficient at cutting the spending on military but still keeping up modern-day defense.
But they did kind of spend a really, really lot of money on that third part of the triad with the submarines.
Well, I just kind of came... It was one of those things where you just could not fall behind, especially after you get accused of missile gapping. You as a party cannot cut corners. So there's this enormous, huge defense budget growth that just continues from 50s, 60s, and 70s onward. And the first hint we got of any kind of, can we finally start to cut back on this, is when? The Soviets fall apart in 1990-91.
TRW and Raytheon were all happy.
Yeah, is the Cold War finally over? Can we now finally plow money back into social spending like we should have been doing all along?
Yeah.
And what happens? 9/11.
Well, also the Gulf War.
Yeah.
But they've already desiccated the U.S. military by then, so.
So then there's all this. Then anybody, Democrat or Republican, who was involved in, you know, cutting back on spending in the 90s, is accused of being someone who endangered our nation's defense. So we have this history since World War II. There's no way out of it. You just must spend forever on excessive amounts of defense, regardless of what that threat is.
Doesn't the Constitution kind of have some structuring that's supposed to kind of prohibit the standing army?
Nothing in the Constitution about that. The spirit of the Second Amendment is that, but that's not in writing, that's in spirit. That's the spirit of the Second Amendment.
No, I mean the part where...
You don't have
the funding can only be for a year or
something
like that.
A lot less jobs.
It's like if we don't have hoes and drugs, we won't generate as much income.
No, that's not like that.
Can I steal the Constitution from you?
You're right, they don't kill.
Still not. A standing army doesn't kill. They stand.
What's their purpose?
They also defend, to be fair, because this is going on the web, and I don't think that's the only purpose of the military.
Can I steal a constitution?
But it can be a misused purpose.
Can I steal a constitution?
Yeah, they have a constitution. It can be a misused purpose. That's why it needs to be managed and contained. And that's why people feared standing armies from the very beginning, the misuse of such power. So JFK and LBJ.
Like, the people running military bases, when it's not during war, is that a standing army?
Yes. If you're not the National Guard or a volunteer militia that pulls the musket from the fireplace to fight, if you are a paid professional for a given enlisted period and that's your job primarily, then you are a standing army. When did we first have continually standing armies not demobilize and stay in large numbers?
World War II.
After World War II, this period we're talking about, this Cold War 47 through 50, which is also where...
Why didn't they demobilize everyone?
Well, two reasons. One was in order to prevent the Depression from coming back, but second, learning the hard way from Hitler that you can't be defended, you have to stay ready for the next threat being the Soviets.
And wasn't it also to keep a huge amount of work, a huge workforce maintained?
Yeah, it was.
But
that didn't have to be for that didn't have to be forever. Well, yeah, it created jobs, but should that be our first line of employment? Should it be government spending?
What? I thought social programs are to...
Well, how about social programs instead of military? If you were going to do it just to spend money to create jobs, how about, like, more schools, teachers, and nurses? And
wouldn't paying someone to clean the airplane that's not going to be used for 10 years, isn't that a good social program?
If there's no other work available, that's a cool thing. How about the airplane that is going to be used?
But that's if it's going to be.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about. That appropriations for standing army cannot be made for more than 2 years at a time.
Yeah, it just means that the Congress has authority to fund or defund.
Yeah. But in a way, it kind of implies armies are supposed to exist for more than 2 years.
So what is it meant? I'll come at it a different way. I can get into it this time. To have a monolithic...
If there had been a standing army...
getting into it.
If there had been a standing army, the South wouldn't have seceded, though. If there were military bases sprinkled throughout all of, and then that whole...
Yeah, and you could also say if we'd had a good standing army, Mexico and Canada would be ours now.
No, standing, not running.
Well, when they are standing, they need to sometimes be put to use in order to justify their standing.
Polish the airplanes.
The monolithic worldview of communism, what do we mean by that?
But it's all controlled by the new Russian Empire.
That's what we mean, is that there is this kind of worldwide connection among all communists, that the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, the Vietnamese, they're all working for one common goal. And if you think about Marxism, that is feasible. What's the common goal of Marxist theory?
Well, total equality.
And eventually a worldwide revolution of working class people overthrowing the bourgeois in each of their countries, creating a network of working class utopias. So it's not all out of sorts to think that if trouble occurs in the Middle East or in South Africa or in Cuba or in Vietnam or in Korea, that somewhere behind all this activity, the money, the guns, and the orders are coming from Moscow. That's what that really means.
Does Moscow have all this money, or is it just like printed off?
They printed it off.
Okay. So
if you stop the growth of communism in Cuba, or you stop the growth of communism in South Vietnam, or hold West Berlin from falling into the Soviet camp, all of this protects the free world from the growth of the Marxist-Soviet threat. And if you are Soviet, the same is true in reverse. That every time you stand up to capitalist aggression somewhere around the world, you're protecting the worldwide Soviet movement.
Even if your economy does collapse on itself, because it doesn't have deficit spending.
Which it did. But that explains why we're involved in so many theaters in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, because it's all part of this, that there is a link going on. And we kind of have the same attitude now, don't we? Or Bush does. What's the major Bush argument for why we have to stay in Iraq?
Because if we leave the regional collapse, and terrorism spread over it.
That's it. The belief that it's a worldwide war on terrorism, and a victory in Iraq is a worldwide victory for the Taliban Al-Qaeda movement. So there is that kind of thinking that what's replaced is the worldwide monolithic Soviet threat is a worldwide terrorist threat. Whether the link is true, whether it ever was true for the first one, is another question. Opponents to this view argued that Russians and Chinese and Cubans and Vietnamese have distinctively different reasons for fighting. They're fighting specific colonial problems, that they're not all Soviet goose-stepping puppets. That in many ways these small states just use the Russians because they can get the money and the guns. And that could have been said with the satellites we had too. That South Korea or the Philippines or El Salvador or whatever country is, or the Shah of Iran are our buddies because knowing that the Cold War is in place, they can get more help and more money from us if they side with us. So that's the climate and atmosphere of the Cold War as it grows in the 50s and 60s. Look at 33 for a second. We talked about the Peace Corps already, right?
Yep.
How can the Peace Corps be viewed as a part of the Cold War?
Well, if you step in and build all these schools and infrastructure and all this to show how good the capitalists are, then they're going to go communist.
And that's the same reason for behind much of the increase in foreign aid that was given to countries in this period. money to help develop schools and education and research and farming, etc. Aid to third world nations was built around this, turned them into successful capitalist nations. They won't listen to Marxism. 34 shouldn't even have to be explained. You've studied so much for tomorrow's test, you can wax and wane on it.
Like, yeah, earlier we pissed off on America, now it's getting their good graces.
That's it. I mean, didn't we yesterday and on the tape explain why from 1896, 1898 to 1930 nearly, why it was that we had bad relations with Latin America?
Spanish-American War, imperialism, or dogma of the sea, and the
corollary.
Roosevelt Corollary.
Yeah. Platt Amendment. So all those things did create a long tradition of resentment among Latin Americans towards us. So it's not surprising when Castro comes to power in Cuba and people like Che Guevara are trying to spread the Castro Revolution throughout Central and South America, we need to start being nice to these people so they don't set up Russian bases in the West.
You know, Che Guevara hated Russia?
I can believe it. See, that's an interesting thing is that here's this so-called monolithic view. In reality, most of the surrogates and puppets hated the Russians and just took their guns and ran. Yeah, and in the other side, too, probably most of our surrogates, our flunkies, hated us.
Actually, a vast number of them actually showed it. Like revolting in Iran and Mujahideen in Afghanistan.
There's something that was added to the... Or something that was passed that made the Roosevelt Corollary
less. Made it more, made it less.
The Clark Memorandum?
Yes, the Clark Memorandum of 1928. Okay. The Clark Memorandum says we hereby renounce Roosevelt Corollary, and then 5 years later, the Good Neighbor Policy in 1933 says we even renounce dog diplomacy. The Clark Memorandum has with it an asterisk that says that doesn't mean we are in no. Doesn't mean we still can't intervene. If necessary, we can intervene on given cases. The Good Neighbor Policy says we'll stop that even.
So it's like we renounce the Roosevelt Corollary, but we don't?
And now...
We'll be softer about it.
And then we'll
finally... So the Alliance for Progress in 1935, I did mention this the other day, was Kennedy's foreign policy towards Latin America that says we want to be friends, we want to help promote their growth, we want to keep freedom alive in those countries. We also, in that effort, start to become much more respectful towards the OAS, promoting it as a regional or the Organization of American States. In many ways, it was kind of like a Western Hemispheric United Nations, where we meet with these nations, we treat them as equals, we try to find common tariff policies, we try to find things to help them with diseases and medical research in those countries. We're trying to be good friends with Latin Americans so they won't listen to the Russians. Organization of American States. Grew out of the old 1889 Pan-American Union negotiated by James G. Blaine.
Didn't Kennedy try to seek approval from the Organization of American States before messing with the Soviets and the Cuban Missile Crisis?
I bet so. I mean, I don't recognize that in my memory, but that sure would sound...
Well, I'm pulling historical facts from the movie 13 Days. So.
Well, I bet he did, because what's the value of doing that?
Well, you have that the whole Western Hemisphere just unifying, saying we're going to blockade you. And
what's a George Bush the Elder parallel?
Oh,
17 member nations of the coalition kicking Hussein out of Kuwait. Arab states involved.
The coalition of the willing. Poland.
Coalition of the coerced. Poland.
Yeah.
Remember when Kerry made the wisecrack about Bush? We need regime change.
Did you see Bill Maher's listing of the Coalition of the Willing?
Yeah, I did. Maher said. Who is Fulgencio Batista?
He was the dictator of Cuba.
From 1934 to 1959. If you've seen Godfather Part 2, It is the Batista regime that is encouraging the investments of those mafia groups and that is overthrown in the movie. That's the coming to power of Castro in that. When Castro comes to power, he doesn't readily, at the very first days of his new administration, reveal himself to be so anti-American and so pro-Russian. And so there is the hope among the Eisenhower administration that maybe he will cooperate and be good and not be since he was a Marxist revolutionary when he was doing the revolution, maybe he was going to settle down and we can buy it off, so to speak.
When did
Castro
take
over? 59. But there is a story as to what caused him to turn more pro-Russian and anti-American, and I don't think this is the only cause. This may have been icing on the cake. I think he was already heading that direction.
Which party was the one in Godfather Part 2 that throwing grenades into cars and stuff?
That's I wouldn't say that's necessarily Castro's people, but the impression is it is.
That's, so Cuba wanted Batista
out.
Okay.
I know you remember this line, where he's talking to Hyman Roth, and he says, I saw an interesting thing today, a revolutionary killed himself and took a police captain with him. He says, what does that tell you? And he says, they can win. The soldiers fight because they're paid. The revolutionaries fight for their own reasons, whatever it is, but the difference is they can win.
Who can win?
The revolutionaries.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. I can't remember the line, but it was a really good line for this issue.
How many times did CIA try to assassinate Castro?
The triple glass, the exploding cigar trick.
Before the cigar trick.
Didn't they have the former girlfriend go and try to poison him? Or?
Yeah. He's still kicking.
Barely.
He's
on TV the other day.
Supposedly the story is this, that in a UN meeting, when a number of foreign dignitaries came to the UN, including Khrushchev from Russia and Castro as the new leader of Cuba, Khrushchev heard that Castro and his entourage were not allowed to go in any of the white hotels and had to go to Harlem to find a place to stay because of the refusal to rent from those people.
Where was this?
This is in New York City. So Khrushchev found out which hotel in Harlem Castro was at and took all the Russian delegation out of the hotel they were in and went to Harlem and moved into the hotel and went and had a conference with Castro and said the classic, there you have it, the capitalists that just can't help but be racist. While we Russians respect the diversity of race. Be a good comic. And supposedly that event and that meeting is what moved Castro over to becoming more pro-Soviet.
That actually happened.
I don't think that's at all the only reason. That they've been icing on the cake. But
this had to be after 1959?
This was 59 turning into 60.
So the public places, were they not integrated by that time?
Just that impression. My impression was that northern cities didn't have such severe Jim Crow, but they may have just had de facto Jim Crow rather than de jure.
But when was it New York City?
Yeah.
The origin story is about New York City hotels being racist against Puerto Ricans.
So probably it's this.
So it may not have been against black people, but Hispanic people.
And Ralph Ellis talks about hotels being racist against black people.
But Khrushchev sure cashed in on it. When Khrushchev was in America on one of these, it may have been this trip, but he wanted very much to visit Disneyland. and the U.S. government just said they denied him because they really didn't believe they could, as open as Disneyland was, they could guarantee his security. And he went home very bitter about not wanting to see him. So even the fierce commies wanted to see Disneyland.
But doesn't Russia have a Disneyland?
No. Paris does.
No.
Paris does.
I think there may have been plans to open St. Petersburg.
One of those Matt the Mouse ice cream things.
You know Billy Crystal, the comedian?
Yeah, I know.
Years ago, when the Russian thaw first occurred, he did a skit about American investors going over to Russia to set up Lenin Land, and it's all going to be kind of a theme park like that. It's so disrespectful.
Isn't that interesting, though? Khrushchev wanted to go to the business park that was created by the company that was created by an anti-Semite.
What?
But he probably didn't know that.
Did you know the Disney logo is the reason copyright laws are like that?
Is there a new legal
deal?
They're
really uptight.
That's why the copyright laws are always changing.
Because the Disney got upset about people stealing
the Mickey Mouse logo from being used for anything.
Oh, I did not know that.
They sued like kindergartens for I remember what it was. This was a story. A grade school had a yearbook with the Mickey Mouse theme, and they made them confiscate all the yearbooks because of copyright.
Yeah, because if you let anyone use it, then anyone else could argue fair use because you allowed someone else to use it without license.
Is that Does anybody remember which cartoon Mickey Mouse first appeared in 1925?
Yep. The AP used the same copyright guidelines of you can't let anyone use it, otherwise you have to let everyone use it, to remove AP chemistry free response questions for one website. Although now they're writing a new license agreement to let people use them.
Well, let's get some Cuba action going before we run out of time. Let's try to get 36 through about, say, 40 going. Kennedy, as young as he was, elected, it gave the impression to some in the Russian camp that now that Eisenhower is gone and there's this young whippersnapper in the office that may be in over his head and doesn't know, maybe we can muscle up on the U.S. and take advantage of his weakness and lack of resolve. And so some of this is, you know, still built around the sting of having finally shot down the U-2 flight and trying to, in a way, balance the power in the world more on the Soviet side against where the Americans had such an enormous amount. So getting a communist leader in Cuba was a real foothold in the Western Hemisphere. Could it spread? Could it spread to Central America and South American nations? That's what they really wanted to see. In a sense, they're thinking liberate the West from capitalism. And we are very, very bothered by the first of a communist thing coming into our hemisphere. So it's not surprising that the very first year that Kennedy's in office, he picks up on an Eisenhower plan that was in the works before Eisenhower left office to try to overturn Castro, the Bay of Pigs incident. It involved CIA-trained Cuban exiles who were going to be sent back to Cuba, land on the beaches, and the expectations were that when we walk into the streets of Baghdad, we'll be greeted as liberators.
Oh, so they land on the beaches. Oh, the Cuban military is there.
That as these Cuban exiles land on the beaches, all the Cubans who hate Castro will rise up with them, and they'll overthrow Castro themselves, and there may not ever have to even be a link that we were involved in doing it. It'll look like their own revolution.
Except that all the poor people liked Castro?
Well, there's two reasons for the failure. One is the secrecy wasn't well kept, and they knew they were coming. And second, what you said is true, is that they were not at a point where people hated Castro. They were somewhat guarded about the fact that he'd involved in mass executions, but they still hated Batista more than Castro, and they hated the U.S. more than they did Castro. So therefore, there was support to defend Castro from what seemed to be an outside-sponsored invasion. And it turned out to be a real big failure and embarrassment, which made Kennedy look even weaker in the world view of standing up to the Soviets.
Did you see the Carlos Mencia thing?
I try not to watch him too much. He's funny sometimes, but sometimes he's kind of...
Maybe after the reporter's off.
Okay.
Is that Dave Chappelle on the Mountain Goose?
I'm thinking about the Castro approval rating schedule.
What's this EH?
Let me finish what I'm thinking, and then I'll come back to you. When being questioned about the Bay of Pigs incident, rather than saying this was an Eisenhower plan that and it's his responsibility, he took full responsibility for it. Yes, I approved of and we launched this. I'm not going to blame anyone else. And he made the comment, was it victory? Has a 100 fathers or 1,000 fathers? And defeat is an orphan? Kennedy did about the Bay of Pigs debacle. I think that's a Kennedy original there. E. Howard Hunt was a spy novel writer who would later be involved in the Watergate break-in and part of the plumbers for the Nixon administration, but he was also involved in the Bay of Pigs incident. And in the movie Nixon by Oliver Stone, there is this kind of continual lurking theme that was E. Howard Hunt's involvement in the Bay of Pigs possibly later connected to the assassination of Kennedy. I don't know. I don't understand the connection, but that's the implication.
So wait, what was his involvement?
He helped plan the Bay of Pigs invasion and was later involved in the Watergate break-in.
And I missed the part of something about
it was Cuban refugees who were in Florida that were trained by the CIA to launch this Bay of Pigs invasion.
That has a list of successes.
Pardon?
Yeah, a nice list of successes.
Oh, E. Howard Hunt?
With Harry's Bay of Pigs and your Watergate break-in?
Yeah.
So is that what...
His illustrious career.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Spy novel writer also. So what's happened here is Communism got a foothold with Castro. An effort to try to dislodge him has failed. Kennedy's looked even weaker. Now Castro looks a hero to his people because, yes, the big Yankee imperialists from the north tried to overthrow us and we succeeded and survived. But the Russians also feel like this probably won't be the only occasion, as you were just joking about earlier, about the numerous attempts by the CIA to have him assassinated. So the Russians want to do something to protect their new foothold in the Western Hemisphere, and what do? They will put missiles in place in item 39, but prior to that, let's look at 38. In direct response to what happened in 37, 38, what happened in Cuba, the Berlin Wall goes up. So this idea of why would you build a wall across Berlin in response to the fact that we tried to invade Cuba?
To protect them from the aggressors.
It's a worldwide linkage. What happens in one part of the world has to be responded to somewhere else. And so the building of the wall was built for two reasons. Their response to the invasion of Cuba, but it's also built
keep these people to get from
because there. So many East Berliners were escaping to the West, the brain drain, as it was called by Castro.
What was the brain drain?
Your better educated scientists and former business and entrepreneurs are all leaving East Berlin to go to free West Berlin where they can be free from communism.
And they still build tunnels under the wall and all that stuff after.
Yeah, so I think that says something about your system. When people are leaving your country to go somewhere else, rather than escaping from other countries to come here, what does that tell you about the appeal of your country?
Not that great.
Yeah. So that was in itself, even though it looked like an act of standing up to the West, from another perspective, that was an admission of failure on the Soviets' part that they were losing their citizens. So, let's get these linkage events together. The Bay of Pigs invasion in 61 leads to the building of the Berlin Wall. So, in response to the Berlin Wall, we put advisors in South Vietnam. 2,000 advisors go to South Vietnam as a way of responding to the wall. And in response to the 2,000 advisors in Vietnam, they put missiles in Cuba. Linkage step by step by step from 60 to 61 to 62.
What do you mean by advisors?
And they give a crap load of weapons.
Green Beret.
You know.
People who can train the South Vietnamese Army to resist.
Kind of annoying, but they're also giving a crap load of weapons to North Vietnam along with the missiles now.
The Russians are?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
What is this?
Which is why we're 37. I think this is just what I've been talking about. JFK wants to look like he can not be pushed around, so that's why he puts the advisors in Vietnam after Khrushchev built the wall in Berlin. So how do we come to know about these missiles in Russia?
YouTube club? Yep. Well, the ones in Russia, we knew they were there because they paraded them through their streets.
Yeah. So another U-2, like the U-2s that have been shot down, we fly U-2s over Cuba, and we find that they are there, but they're not set up and in place for action yet. So as there is a secret meeting among the top advisors of the Kennedy administration, what are we going to do before these things are in place and can be used? And military advice is attack now immediately before they're in place. And Kennedy's reaction is, I don't want to be the first president to pull a Pearl Harbor. That's George Bush's job later. He didn't say that. History said it. He didn't want to be the first president to pull Pearl Harbor. So there are unofficial negotiations that began to take place between Kennedy and Khrushchev. And the way they take, not directly to each other, the way they work is Bobby Kennedy speaks to a newspaper reporter. I used to know that guy's name. It may be Drew Pearson. But he speaks to a newspaper reporter who speaks to the Russian ambassador, who then speaks to Khrushchev. So through the Russian ambassador and the newspaper reporter, through Bobby Kennedy, Kennedy and Khrushchev are indirectly negotiating. And, of course, what we want is the missiles taken out. Khrushchev alludes and hints that he might be willing to refrain from any further setting up of the missiles. We will promise to remove missiles from Turkey.
Which are obsolete anyway.
Yeah, which are obsolete anyway, which is to Kennedy's advantage to do. But if he does do that, what?
Well, they only say he's caving into communism.
Right.
Is the news reporter the Scally, John Scally?
He might be, if that name's in there. Yep, that's him. But Drew Pearson was the one that was kicked in the balls by McCarthy in the 50s in an elevator.
What?
Yeah. Pearson was called a commie, and when he got in an elevator with McCarthy, he started to give him what for, and McCarthy just kneed him. Doors opened up, he walked off.
Did he walk off drinking a fifth or something?
Probably.
Who McCarthy
mean? Yeah, Drew Pearson. I'll tell you, probably look up in here in the 50s.
You got to look McCarthy.
So, yeah, Scali was the reporter that was negotiating with the Russian ambassador. So these are the unofficial negotiations that are going on, and if they can just get the Turkish missile incident solved, that'll solve also. Well, in the waters of the Caribbean, the choice that Kennedy made was to set up what he called a quarantine, a line of ships which block further entrance to Cuba of more Soviet ships.
Well, they inspect the Soviet ships.
They're going. If they try to run the quarantine, they'll be inspected. They'll be stopped and inspected. If they can be stopped.
Yeah.
And so the Russian ships approach this thing, and the big worry is, what if the Russian ships' military defy the blockades, which you really should call it if you're calling it the truth?
They actually fired star shells at one of the cargo ships,
didn't they? Yeah, they did. And the reason Kennedy took the name quarantine rather than blockade was because blockade is technically an act of war.
Well, in Times Square, they put the running marquee was blockade. So.
And if the Russians had run it, then it would have been... Yeah, it would have been war.
Especially
at that point, then the missiles of both sides could have flown. And that's that story I'm telling you where I was in the third grade, going through the get under the desk and under the concrete drills.
Well,
what's this quarantine? Is this to get the Turkish missiles?
The quarantine is the naval blockade to stop any further ships from coming in carrying more missiles.
To Cuba.
While they're doing the negotiations through the newspaper reporter.
Two things. Wasn't it revealed later that the Soviet submarines traveling with the convoys were actually armed with nuclear torpedoes?
I think I've heard that.
And also, wasn't the person made nearly fired for putting the U.S. forces on DEFCON 2?
Could be, though.
That's a big part of 13 Days.
That's why I ought to watch that
Kenny's
film.
Kenny's claiming he'll have LeMay's head on a platter.
What am I thinking? I need to get back on target of what I'm talking about here.
Talking about a quarantine.
Oh, okay, here's what I'm thinking. As the ships approached the quarantine and stopped and turned around and went back, Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, for Kennedy and later Johnson, is remembered as having said, "We were just eyeball to eyeball and the other guy blinked." That quote comes from the Russians turning around and leaving. And through the negotiations, finally Kennedy agreed, we will remove the missiles from Turkey, but it won't be right away. It'll be 6 months later, so it doesn't look like it has any connection that we caved in.
That was 3 months later.
It's 6 months from what I remember.
It's just 3 months on your sheet.
I think I'm wrong.
I
think the sheet's wrong. I think, of course, I probably built the sheet from a book, so the book may be right, but I'm thinking 6 months. So the way to write this essay is a number of months after the incident. Turkish missiles were to be...
It was delayed to look like they were slated for removal anyway.
Well, the crisis was avoided. Missiles were just all the stuff in Cuba was taken back down. Russian troops were removed. We actually won the situation. Khrushchev did not start. We did not start World War III. Khrushchev was so embarrassed by what happened, he was removed from office by 64, replaced by Brezhnev. And Russia and the United States, realizing how communications need to be immediate between the leaders, not being running through newspaper reporters, set up what?
The hotline
of the red phone to deal with further crises. The time period we're talking about here, early 60s, Cold War friction, chance of war breaking out by accident, two movies really worth seeing. A serious one about this incident called Failsafe, where Henry Fonda is the president. And then a film that is the same theme, ridiculous but hilarious, Dr. Strangelove. Very good thing.
It's not ridiculous.
It's a good ridiculous.
Is Failsafe the one
it's
where
a
they...
satire.
Is Failsafe
a serious subject?
Is Failsafe the one where they nuke Moscow and they nuke New York?
Yes, but they trade off Moscow for New York and Failsafe.
Because they lost the radios and won the bombers.
But when you watch those films and realize they're made, I think both made in 64, that they... Dr. Strangelove was the first film to poke fun at the Cold War. No film before that had done so.
Mr. Fisher mentioned Failsafe in his class, but he didn't remember the name of it.
The movie?
Yeah.
So we are down to 42 Vietnam. Can you check and see if it's 3 months rather than 6 months? Maddie's at lunch. Yes.
This 41 is that. What's the Chinese?
Okay. Up until the mid 60s, there was the appearance of unity between the Russians and the Chinese. This so-called monolithic image. He's asked about the first part of 41. And when Stalin died, who became at that point the longest sitting, most senior commie leader in the world? So shouldn't the worldwide communist revolution be dictated, getting orders out of Peking from now on?
No, that's it.
They're just not white. The Russians are still going to run this show. So after Khrushchev takes over for Stalin, and the Chinese feel very dislike they're second-class citizens in the Soviet Empire, there's bad blood growing, and when Khrushchev doesn't stand up to the paper tiger American and blow up everybody in the world, Chinese think that the Russians have lost their authority to lead the war, and so there's the Sino-Soviet split that starts to grow in the mid-60s. And there's other causes, too, but in the mid-60s, the Russians and Chinese start to become really frictional with each other, and that's what Nixon jumps on in 72 to try to widen the gap of.
So that was another reason why Khrushchev was replaced, because
the Chinese were so
angry.
Yeah, and the Russians wanted to be able to show a stronger leadership front, so they replaced him with Brezhnev. And Brezhnev would stay in office till 82, I think. There'd be a couple people, but from 82 to 85, and then who would come to office? Gorbachev, then Yeltsin. So let's get a little more Vietnam here before we run.
What number?
We're on 42. Let's do a little calendar thinking. We need to make it to
87.
I'm thinking 93, 96. Need to make it up to about Ford becoming president in 96. Everything after that on those last two sheets, you don't have to know everything in there. I can just pick and choose which ones have been on previous AP tests. And it looks like we'll finish the New Deal in the mornings. We've got one more week to do the New Deal. So, finishing these things in my hand, picking the tidbits out of here, talking about some stuff about colonial history that we never did, that's what our next week entails. How many days after school are people willing to spend?
All of them.
All of them for me, too. But if there are days that you have to have your tonsils taken out or something like that, I don't want you to miss notes. So are there any days like that?
Is May 3rd going to happen this week? Yes, it is.
You got soccer
Thursday.
Yet?
It doesn't say when it happened, but it says that Kennedy had already ordered their removal before the Cuban Missile Crisis even occurred.
I think that's true. And then he put a stop on the order when it looked like it.
Yeah,
sure was going to get
that
something.
Way he wasn't acting under the gun.
Right.
And he also removed him from Italy and Britain.
But there's no months given?
No. Pretty much he just removed all the liquid fuel missiles.
Okay. Well, should we just shoot? Do we need to get every day, or is that too much? How about a Monday? You want to do a Monday?
Let's not do a Monday.
Monday is bad. Do you have other commitments?
Or can we do it later?
Like we have so many Mondays to choose.
Can we do it in the evening? Like not after school, but late? Can we come back to school?
How long after school are you committed?
Till 5:30.
I guess I could come back. I could come back, go home and come back. It's going
to
create a little tension with the wife after she's been gone for a week. But
I might be able to.
But I love her.
I could probably get out of that because I won't be able to come here Tuesday. So I should. So
Monday would work. But is that a comeback in the evening? Or it would sure be better for me if I could do it after school. Then I know work for you guys.
That works for me.
When is this?
I'm just going to quit my job. So.
Are you working Monday?
I'm scheduled to work all week, but I'll just.
Well, I don't want you to quit your job just for this.
I do, though. I don't like working there. I called in today if I could be here.
It's so nice of you. I'm sorry to do
that. What are we saying about Canada?